Left Field Investors is a community dedicated to limited partner investors who are interested in building wealth through real estate investing. The community is focused on education, networking, and engagement with quality operators and partners. We provide tools, webinars, and a forum where members can discuss everything related to real estate investing, including deals, operators, investment strategies, and much more. Coming soon, we're adding a new tool, sponsor reviews. This will be a place where our members can rate and review operating partners to further help each other in our investment journeys. Check us out at leftfieldinvestors.com.
As you decrease interest rates, everything that is around interest rates, everything based on interest rates becomes easier. So a lot of people who invested in deals in 16 and 17, and then they sold in 19 and the NOI was the same, they still made a ton of money.
Hello, left fielders. Welcome to the Passive Investing from Left Field podcast. Our community is focused on networking and education to help people invest passively and think differently. Let's go.
This is Brian Burke from Praxis Capital, and you are listening to the Passive Investing from Left Field podcast.
I'm really excited today to have James Eng with us. He's known as the professor of multifamily financing. He has over 18 years experience in commercial real estate lending and is currently the national director at Old Capital. He's worked with hundreds of investors to help them acquire over $1.5 billion in multifamily properties, totaling over 20,000 units nationwide. In addition to financing multifamily, he's invested in over 10,000 units as a limited partner in nearly 40 properties in Texas. James, welcome to the Passive Investing from Left Field podcast.
Jim, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great. You know, our community was really excited about this interview, so I want to jump right in. But first, can you share your journey? How did you get into real estate? How did you get into lending? Just kind of tell us how you got to where you are today.
Yeah. So I'll go back and do a quick recap. So born and raised in Houston, Texas, went to school in Austin at UT, did finance there, and then really started my career at GE Capital. So they had a finance management program where they sort of moved you around to different places all throughout the country, and they gave you 6 months to sort of figure it out, and then they moved you to the next spot. So I did 6 months in Connecticut, 6 months in Denver, and then my third rotation was actually here in Dallas at their real estate group. And so I was an underwriter for them for 10 years. And that was really on the balance sheet CMBS loan platform that they had. And so I underwrote, you know, industrial, office, retail, multifamily. And it was really from the loan side of saying, all right, if we give you the money, how are we going to get it back? And I was there from 2005 to 2015. So a pretty interesting time sort of looking back and saying, all right, so what happened sort of 9, 10, 11, 12 in that time frame? We had to take a lot of deals back. And we took almost everything back except two property types, and they were multifamily and self-storage. And so when I started looking at what am I going to invest in personally, I started looking sort of 13 and 14 into multifamily and self-storage. And that's sort of what I knew, and I knew it did well. And so 2014, I started looking around trying to figure out how I'm going to do that. And then in 2015, they actually sort of sold off all the pieces of GE Capital. And the first piece to go was real estate. And so this guy came down from Connecticut, and they said, everybody in the Dallas office, there was like 250 people, all you guys, in like 3 months, you're not going to be here. And here, grab the envelope on your way out. And so that was a shock. And it was funny was because there's people in the room, obviously, like you could hear a pin drop in that room. It was dead silent. And almost everybody who had money saved and who had cash flow from other sources besides their job, they were like, all right, whatever, I'll get 3 months off and then I'll, you know, get to do whatever I want. It doesn't matter. But the people who had no savings and people who had no sort of passive income anywhere else, like they were in freakout mode. Like they pretty much just started going and applying for jobs at other banks like immediately. You know, I sort of moved over to Old Capital at that point and started learning more about multifamily investing, started doing what I realized that, you know, I put a bunch of money in 401ks and Roth IRAs at that point. And what I realized is that they don't really pay you anything when you were my age. So I was only 10 years out of school. So I decided that I'm going to start investing passively into deals so that I have what people call realized recurring income. So I started looking at multifamily, started doing multifamily at that point, lending as a broker on it, but then also investing in it. So since then, I've probably done about 45 deals as a passive in multifamily, and probably about 20 of those have sold. So I'm in probably 23, 24 of them right now, and all in Texas. So I have not diversified outside of multifamily, and I'm not diversified outside of Texas. So those are the multifamily is what I know the best. And so I pick my operators, pick my markets that way. And that's the recap. That's the short recap.
No, that's great. A couple of questions. You know, let's start right with the, you know, people talk about diversification. I like to diversify by market, asset class, you know, and sponsor. And it sounds like you're all in multifamily and all in Texas. So I guess you've kind of explained why multifamily, but why Texas? And do you feel like you're too concentrated? I mean, obviously not. You've had success there, but can you talk about that concentration?
You know, I think, you know, most of the checks I write are anywhere from 100 to, let's say, 200 or 300. And so I don't feel like it's a huge concentration in that regards, in terms of total net worth to limited partnership investments. But you know, in terms of Texas, Texas versus like going to Phoenix or going to Atlanta or going to any of these other markets that a bunch of people have been to, I just don't know them as well. And so I just don't know the market, and I don't know the general partners in those markets as well as I know Texas. And so you know, the stat that I saw that made me more comfortable was, you know, the Texas economy is as big as the Canadian economy. So, you know, if investing in all of Canada is something the size of all of Canada, then I feel comfortable.
Yeah. And it makes sense, right? When you, it's different when you know something, you know, really deep, then, you know, diversification isn't as necessary. When you don't have the depth of knowledge, then you spread out your investments, and diversification is more important, I think. You also mentioned that, you know, you kind of started in your career in interesting times, right? And we are in, again, interesting times. And this time, it focuses a lot on multifamily and interest rates. So what is the state of multifamily financing right now?
I would first start with multifamily benefits from having Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And so if you do not understand the financing of multifamily in comparison to other commercial assets, that's, I would start there, because other asset types, they really, like, let's say, whether it's industrial or office or retail, they only get the benefit of really banks and then maybe CMBS. And so, and maybe your higher quality stuff is like life insurance, but multifamily gets this huge benefit of having Fannie and Freddie, and they put out about 75 to 80 billion in loans a year right now. And so that is a huge benefit. And it also, you know, indicates why multifamily has still traded a lot, in the last year. You know, I think to give you the quick history, sort of from my seat, let's say 2015 to 2019, pretty much in multifamily, majority of investors did Fannie and Freddie fixed rate debt. And so that was 5-7, 10-year fixed rate at anywhere from probably 4.5% to 5.5% all in. And that was all great, and it worked well. And, you know, people got mad that they had a little bit of a prepayment penalty when they went and sold, because, you know, they bought in 15, sold in 17. They still had 8 years left on that 10-year loan, and so they had a prepayment penalty. But what happened really in 2020 was the rates dropped so significantly. So rates dropped on the 10-year treasury from, you know, typically 3-3.5% down to less than 1% when COVID happened. And when that happened, your all-in rate dropped to 3%. And so Fannie and Freddie were the only people in the game in 2020. So pretty much everyone did Fannie and Freddie loans in 2020. What really changed was in 2021. 2021, 2022, essentially everybody went to what was essentially a shorter term floating rate loan, which was a bridge loan. And the reason that they did this was that Fannie and Freddie were sizing off of in-place debt service coverage of 125. And so let's say me and you were going to buy a deal in 2021 and it's $10 million. Okay, Jim. So what type of leverage would Fannie and Freddie give you? Let's say $6 million or $7 million. Okay. The problem was when the deal was $10 million, how many people were bidding on that deal, you think, for $10 million if I could get $6 million on a Fannie loan? Any guesses?
I would say a lot.
Let's say 40 people were bidding on that deal. 40 offers. Okay.
Right.
So they go, all right. People put in their bids. They got 40 offers at 10 million. Then it goes to 11 million, then 12 million, then 13 million, 14 million, the purchase price. And then they go to best and final. How many people are in the best and final? There's still 10 people in the best and final. Right. So it goes to 15 million, 16 million, $17 million. What is the Fannie Mae loan on that $16 or $17 million deal? Any guesses?
I would say it's still similar to what it was before.
It's the exact same because Fannie and Freddie are doing it based off of the in-place cash flow. So they're sizing to a 125 debt service coverage on in-place income. And so they're saying, all right, we can give you $6 million. But now this is 2021, 2022. People are paying $16, $17, $18 million for this deal. And so we would show them, all right, here's your Fannie Mae loan and here's your bridge loan option. And the bridge loan would essentially be anywhere from 70 to 80% of purchase price plus 100% of the rehab. So let's say you're buying this deal and then you're putting $2 million in rehab. So we would give you 80% of the purchase price plus 100% of the rehab. So your loan could be like $16 million on an $18 million purchase. So you would have to only raise like 20% of the deal. And so this is really what happened in 21 and 22 that spurred the sort of insane cap rate compression that basically took cap rates all the way down to, let's say, 3.5% to 4%. And now that the Fed, so starting summer or March of 22, the Fed started on this interest rate hike environment, and that pretty much it took SOFR from zero all the way up to 5.5%. And now people on those floating rate deals, so typically it was SOFR plus 3, SOFR plus 4. So now you are anywhere from 8 to 9% all in on your interest rate, and your cap rate is 4 or 5 that you bought at. And so pretty much everybody on a bridge loan is upside down. And so what we've seen in the last 12 months in 2023 was that everyone went back to the beginning, where we started from 2015 to 2019, when everyone was doing Fannie and Freddie fixed rate debt. That's all we did last year. Everyone went back to the Fannie and Freddie fixed rate debt at 60% leverage. And some deals could pencil, but majority of the deals that were sold last year were sold. They had been owned since 17, 18, and 19. They were not deals purchased in 21 and 22. But this year is the beginning. So majority of the deals bought in 21 had 3-year loan terms, and those loans are closed. Those maturities are coming due this year. And so that is what everybody is waiting for to some extent, is all these maturities on these bridge loans to come due and buy these deals essentially either for the loan amount or a little bit above, a little bit below. And if you are in those deals, essentially your LP position, if you have to sell in the next 2 years, will be not 2x. It might be a 0.1x on those deals.
And there's no solution to this. I mean, it just has to work itself out, right? Because you have all these loans. Are banks or lenders, are they doing workouts to, they just want their capital back, right? They don't want the building. So how is this? I mean, you've said that 2024 is the year of the refi, but with rates still high, does that, you can refi, but you're not really, you might still lose all the LP equity. So can you talk about what do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, people are doing different things. I would say if you're sitting there as a GP, what you, your choice is to go back to your limited partners and let's just take that deal. Let's say you took a $15 million loan when you bought the deal in 21, and now the Fannie loan sizes for 10 million. So now you've got a $5 million gap. So you can go back to the existing LPs and have people contribute that money. And that, you know, that's just a normal cash in refi. If the LPs say, nope, we're not doing that, then now people are going to preferred equity providers, and those preferred equity providers are stepping in front of those limited partners and they're putting in the money. So that's sort of the second step. The third step is you go to the lender and you ask for an extension. Majority of these deals, there was a 3-year term plus 2 1-year extensions, but the extension was essentially hurdled on a debt yield that is very similar to the 125 cover. So most people cannot hit that extension. And so they have to pay down the loan by a significant amount to hit that extension. But you're going to try to work it out with the lender in order to, maybe you don't pay it all the way down, maybe you get it there halfway, to cut a deal so that they give you the extension. Because I can't remember the study, and this is sort of how I look at deals the most, is that like pretty much any 10-year period, if you bought a deal in any 10-year and you held it for 10 years, in any cycle, any period, you did not lose money in real estate, but you had to hold the 10 years. And so I think right now, it's only been like 2.5-3 years. And so it's going to take time for this thing to write itself out, to write this ship. And so what we've seen a lot of people do is, they have done the cash in refi. They have taken the preferred equity. They've taken the mezz loan. They've done whatever is necessary to kick the can further down the road. Some people can only kick. So ideally, you would kick the can 5 years, 7 years, 10 years into a Fannie, Freddie, or HUD loan. If you can't do that, you're buying the 1-year interest rate cap and you're getting the extension from the bridge lender.
Well, let's talk about the rate caps then, because, you know, interest rates, they're signaling that, you know, maybe they cut this year at some point in some fashion, but not a whole bunch, right? Some.
Right.
And so I think a lot of LP investors, you know, fingers crossed, let's hope it's March, let's hope it's May. But whenever it is, that's going to rescue everything, which I don't think it will. But if rates go down, does that mean that the rate caps, the cost of those go down? Will banks release the escrows that they've been holding on to? Will that rescue some of the deals? I mean, there's a lot of questions there, but can you just talk about what interest rates will do to rate caps, I guess?
Yeah. So just so everyone understands, like, so in 2021, when all these bridge loans were being put on, you know, your interest rate was SOFR plus, let's say 3 to make the math easy. And SOFR was essentially 0 or 0.25. And so your all-in rate when you started in 2021 was 3.25. And SOFR was 0.25, and then you could buy a cap on SOFR. And to buy a cap on SOFR was probably less than 1% of the loan amount. So you could essentially, you know, pay $50,000 and you could get a 3-year cap and it at 1% and cap SOFR at 1% for 3 years in 2021. Because the Fed kept saying, we're not raising rates all throughout 2021. And then not until the end of 2021 did they say, hey, we might start raising rates here. And so essentially when you go and price an interest rate cap now that the Fed has raised the SOFR by that much, right now to buy a 3-year cap, it is about 6% of the loan amount. And that is a significant increase from where it was. And so people have to come up with that money if they need to, if they do a new deal, a new bridge loan. But most people are only extending it for 1 year. And 1 year is about 3% of the loan amount for a 2% strike, which is what most people want to be around. And so that price has not come down. It's come down about 25% since the, I would say, probably December meeting. Where he came out and said, we're going to do 3 rate cuts in 24. But it has not, the next drop in the price is really going to be when they actually cut. And so whether that's in May or June or whenever it is, that that next cut is when interest rate caps will come down. But they are coming it down off an extremely high number.
So you don't think that will save any of these deals that people are kind of, you know, like LPs, fingers crossed, hopefully the rate cuts save us.
So, yeah, so it's not necessarily the actual rate that's hurting you. It is the leverage that the deal was done at. Because that is the amount that you have to pay down that loan by to get it back to a Fannie. So Fannie and Freddie right now are probably 5.5% to 6% on interest rate. And they're sizing on a 125 cover. And so that $5 million gap that we talked about between the $10 million Fannie loan and the $15 million bridge loan, that's the gap that is hurting people the most. It is not necessarily the monthly interest rate charge that is happening right now.
So is there anything that LP investors can do on their current deals? I mean, this is part of the problem, or not problem, but it's an issue of being an LP investor is you do all your due diligence up front, you wire your money, and then you just kind of sit back and you hope, right, that you get distributions, that you get reports. Well, and eventually your capital back. But on some of these deals that are going south, the only choice really is to evaluate whether you participate in a capital call or you don't, if there is that choice. So is there anything else LP investors can do as far as, you know, analyzing or figuring out if they're going to get through this on some of their deals?
So obviously, you know, there's more to do on the front end than the back end, right? So in terms of analyzing the deal, in terms of leverage, floating versus fixed, all that type of stuff, that's probably number one. But once you're in the deal, as an LP, you really don't have that much control. To me, the only thing that I've seen happen, but it is still pretty hard to do, is if you think the general partner is not pulling their weight in the deal and not doing what they were supposed to do, then I've seen LPs get together to replace that general partner. And I've also seen lenders replace general partners with a general partner that they think is better suited to run that deal. But, you know, that's I would say that's 1 out of 100. So, you know, your choice as an LP right now in a lot of these deals is whether to contribute to the capital call. And as an LP, I probably want to contribute to deals that I am getting to a solution that goes out 5 years, not 1 year.
And so is that when you're looking at that, then as an LP, you're looking at, okay, is the business plan still on track? Is it just an interest rate problem or a rate cap problem, something like that? But also the length of, like, if I give this capital call, are they trying to bridge 1 year? Maybe bridge right. is the wrong word, but are they trying to get me through 1 year? Are they trying to get me through five? And if it's a short-term fix, you're probably less likely to think that's a good one to participate on.
Yeah, I'd rather be using the capital call money to get to a Fannie Freddie HUD refi so that I'm getting 5, 7, 10 years on this deal versus I'm putting in money and I'm buying a 1 year interest rate cap. Because 12 months from now, I still have a problem.
Right.
And so I'm trying to solve the problem, not just like put a Band-Aid on the problem, because the Band-Aid is going to fall off and I'm still going to have a problem 12 months from now.
Right. I think part of the challenge is as LPs, we got so used to deals being advertised as 5 years, but then they'd go full cycle in 2 or 3 because the market sure. was just so hot. And now we're saying, hey, you got to slow down. Not only are you going to put more money in, but it might be 7 years or 8 or 9 years before you get your capital back. And that's a huge adjustment mentally for LPs to make.
No, I 1,000% agree. You know, I think, you know, we've been spoiled the last, let's say, 8, 9 years. I mean, it's been a great run for multifamily. It's been a great run for anything that, you know, has had interest rates tied to it. And I think, you know, one of my favorite guys is Howard Marks. I'm sure you guys have read his memos, but, like, you know, his last memo in January was talking about easy money. And as you decrease interest rates, everything that is around interest rates, everything based on interest rates, becomes easier. So a lot of people who invested in deals in 16 and 17, and then They sold in 19 and the NOI was the same. They still made a ton of money. But right now, you could increase your NOI by 20, 30% and lose money. So it's just, it's a completely different game right now.
Yeah, no, it certainly is a different game. And that, and you got to acknowledge that and play the game that's being played, right?
Circus City's trademarks were acquired and it was relaunched in 2018 with a fully online technology-focused strategy. It's an iconic brand with a rich history, now operating as a tech-driven e-commerce enterprise and steering clear of brick-and-mortar stores. Since its online revival, Circus City has achieved over $130 million in revenue, is already profitable, and on a path towards a multi-billion dollar valuation. Circus City's Series A funding round is now open for accredited investors, targeting an over 7x multiplier through a 2028 sale or IPO in U.S. capital markets. To learn more about this exclusive opportunity, visit invest.circuitcity.com. That's invest.circuitcity.com.
Hi folks, Ben Lapidus here, your host of the Best Ever Conference, dropping some exciting news. If you are a passive investor looking for a like-minded network and dozens of high-quality operators to personally meet, then you're going to want to hear more about this incredible new mashup. Left Field Investors is joining this year's Best Ever Conference to create the most exclusive combination of networking and conference content available to the passive investor community anywhere. If you're already an infielder, then you get access to both events for less than the cost of one. And if you're not an infielder, then what are you doing? Sign up already! In addition to a year's membership, you get access to the LFI Day at Best Ever Conference on April 9th in Salt Lake City, followed by three phenomenal days of learning and connecting at the 8th annual Best Ever Conference, where hundreds of operators showcase their best deals and hundreds of passive investors come to learn, invest, and party with each other. We have many masterminds, game shows, intellectual debates, pitch competitions, speed networking, partner hunting, almost 100 speakers, party after party after party, and the tail end of snow season in beautiful Salt Lake Valley. Be sure to claim an exclusively discounted price of $800 and join us in Salt Lake April 9th through 12th for the event of the year. Check us out at besteverconference.com for more info.
And I don't know if this is a question for you or a tax person, but you know, a lot of these deals that they're selling earlier than the business plan, right? Whether it's on purpose or most likely in this environment, not on purpose, but you got to just sell and maybe you lose all the investor capital, but you pay off the loan. How does that work with depreciation, right? We had all this 100% bonus depreciation. Then if you sell early and maybe the LPs lose their capital, then do they also have a recapture on the back end that kind of amplifies that loss?
I think there is a recapture.
It worse.
Yeah. So if you put in 100, not that I'm a CPA, or play one on the internet.
Right.
So if you put in 100,000, you took 100,000 of depreciation, right? And then, so your basis is negative 100,000 or whatever it is. And now you've got to recapture that, at the end of the investment. Yeah, you pay 25% tax on 100,000, so 25,000. So
plus the 100,000 that you just lost.
Well, the 100,000 you lost is gone. So
yeah, it's gone.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So
yeah, that's not good news. So
I know some people who took 200% depreciation. So
right, it comes back to you. So I posted in our infield community in our forum that you were going to be on the podcast. And I got a bunch of questions from the community that they were dying to ask you. So I am going to do that on their behalf. And you kind of answered the first one, was how should LPs respond to capital calls? And I think you kind of answered that. But talk about preferred equity. Like, what is the role? How should LPs look at that? It's hard for us to be able to invest in it. But when preferred equity is coming in on one of our deals, how should we feel about it? How do you think about preferred equity?
So if I'm investing in a deal, like writing the first check, I don't want preferred equity in front of me, because the way you got to think about it is there's the senior loan and then now pref equity is in front of you. And that is usually juicing the returns of the overall deal, quote unquote, but it is increasing the risk. And so the way I like to look at it is, let's say your loan is 70% and now they're putting 15% preferred equity. the pref equity guys got to eat before you. And so you've got to pay them out of the property's cash flow, some current number, and then plus some accrued number, and then you're after them. So to me, it's increased risk on a new deal. On an existing deal, let's say you bought a deal in 21 and it was just common equity, but now you know, you go back to the LP, say, hey, LPs, we need $5 million. And the LPs are like, sorry, we can't do it. And so the deal's going to get foreclosed on, right? Because they need the money. And so now that's a pretty crappy position to be in. But a pref guy comes in and says, look, I understand you need $5 million and I'm going to charge you 8% current and 8% accrued. And we're going to give you the $5 million. Me as an LP, I'm okay with that position, even not that I have a huge vote, but that's the position that I think preferred equity should be used from a GP perspective if you cannot raise the money from the LP, because you are protecting the overall deal. I don't like the pref equity when it's just to juice the returns of the LP. Because in reality, if they could raise all the money from common, I would just do it that way. But either they can't raise the money or they want to show a higher return to the LPs, the common, by using the pref equity. Because the pref equity usually has a set return, like 8 and 8. So you're capped in at 16. And then once I pay you the 16%, you go away. You don't get any more of the upside. And the upside is going to the common. But that upside is at a price. And that price is you have to pay them first.
Right. And so when syndicators, how do they set the rate for the preferred equity, like in a distressed deal? We've seen, you know, ranges from the 8% you're talking about all the way up to 18%. So how do they set that?
It is a race to the bottom. So like everything, it's demand and supply. So if the general partner needs preferred equity, they can go to a broker similar to what we do on the debt side, and they will take it out and say, all right, how many bids do I get back? Right? If I get one bid at 10 and 10, 10 current and 10 accrued, that's your guy.
Right.
But if I've got five guys, they're going to bid against each other to get it down. To take on, all right, maybe I get it down to 7 and 7 and 7 current, 7 accrued. And then some guys are approved to go behind the agencies like Fannie and Freddie. So it's all these things that you're going to, and then there's going to be language between, there's going to be an agreement between the general partner and the preferred equity as well, and preferred equity and the lender. And so you've got to work through all those things. It's not just the rate.
Right. Okay. And then we've talked a little bit about this, but maybe dig in a little bit more, the dynamic between operators with distressed deals and their lenders. What kind of workouts are being negotiated? Do you think there'll be fewer distressed sellers in 2024 because banks are going to try working out these deals? So start there, and then I got a couple follow-ups.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, what we've seen is if you're going to get any sort of concession from the lender, usually they are asking for something from you in terms of a pay down or an interest reserve or posting some money up with them for something. And so it usually is not like, well, we'll just give you the extension. No worries. See you next year. Usually you're having to give something up. And for the general partnership groups who are not willing to give something up, they're sort of stuck. And, you know, we've probably seen, I would say probably 5 or 6 foreclosures in Houston in 2023. We haven't really seen one in Dallas yet of size. But in Houston, there's been 4 or 5 foreclosures where, you know, they tried to come to agreement, nothing happened, boom, lender took the deal back. So we are seeing some workouts, but I would say they are done very quietly and they are really just extensions by 6 months or a year. They're really not giving anything else besides time.
Okay. Yeah, and then what happens to the lenders who have originated a lot of variable rate debt? Are they going to have trouble? I mean, so far it seems like, you know, when a deal goes bad, it's the LPs or the equity is gone, but they still pay off most or all of the debt. But are some of these lenders going to be in trouble as well?
So, this sort of goes back to what happened when I worked at GE, is that there are people who originate loans and those loans sit on their balance sheets and they manage them and they use their own money essentially to originate those loans. And so if you had to take write downs on all those, then that one bank would be responsible for those loans, for those losses. But a lot of these deals, what happened was people would originate the loan and then they would get securitized into the market. And that investor, whoever bought that security, when it was securitized, is going to take the loss. And so what's hard is the number of bridge lenders that were in the space in 21 and 22. I mean, there was probably anywhere from 30 to 50 bridge lenders all competing for the same deals. And that's why it was raced to the bottom in terms of leverage and interest rate and quality of the borrower, quality of the property. And all these guys put these deals together, packaged them up, and then sold it to the investor. So usually, are you familiar with CMBS tranches and securitization tranches?
I think you should explain. I'm vaguely, but yeah. Okay. Let's.
So imagine taking like 10 loans or 20 loans, and it's $1 billion. So you got $1 billion, and now basically they put them together and they say, all right, now investors can buy these loans, right? And there's usually the rating agencies will give it a AAA rating, which is the highest rating, and that is the lowest risk part of the tranche. And then it'll go all the way down to essentially what's called the B piece or the very last piece. And that is the highest risk, but you get the highest interest rate. So you as an investor can buy a AAA tranche, a AA tranche, all the way down to the riskiest piece, which is the B piece. And so investors bought this stuff, right? Because it goes back to, do you remember what your savings account was paying in 2021? Zero.
Yeah, zero.
Right? Yes. In some places, like in Europe, it was like negative, right? So yeah. When interest rates are that low, when you're saying, hey, here's a piece of paper that is, you know, 10-year treasury is 1%, your savings account is zero. Here's a piece of paper that'll pay you 4%. It was getting gobbled up like nothing, right? And so all those investors who bought up all that paper, they're like, U.S. multifamily, we're in the debt position. There's 20% equity in front of us. It's floating rates. So if the Fed raises rates, my interest, my payment goes up. All right, sounds good. It's AAA rated. And so all this paper was bought. And so what's hard is when that paper is bought, it is typically serviced by like a third party. And so a lot of these third parties are going to be dealing with these issues where they've got an investor on one side, they've got a borrower on the other side, and they're going to try to talk to each other through a loan agreement that's 155 pages. And trying to figure out what the best, so it's not going to be quick, these workouts. And it's not going to be, you know, standard cookie cutter, like Fannie and Freddie documents. They are very standard boilerplate. Like you look at one, you've seen them all. But if you look at these loan agreements for bridge loans, if I wanted to tweak, you know, something on page 175, because my attorney didn't like the language, he could have. So all these bridge loan documents are completely different for each one of these deals.
And does this, I mean, it sounds familiar, right? It sounds a little bit like 2008, where you had all these loans securitized and divvied up and then everything imploded. I mean, you're not predicting that. It's just that they're, because it's a subset of that, the whole real estate market, but that could cause some issues because it's people 3-4 steps down the line that are going to end up losing on this.
Yeah, the investors who bought the paper are going to end up losing, because I mean, unless they're able to work these deals out, and I mean, it's the same thing with like people who have, you know, loans on malls. You know, they're still trying to work some of these malls out.
Right.
And it's going to take some time. And the hard thing is that market is very, there's not a ton of transparency in that market. Like from my seat, I do not know who owns all that paper.
Right. Okay. So shifting gears a little bit, I don't even know how to answer this question, but the scenarios for LPs who invested in deals the last few years, where are you looking? Optimistic, realistic, pessimistic. So where do you think that, how should they be looking at this, I guess? And we've talked a little bit about this, but if you're an LP and you know, invested in five or six deals over the last 2 or 3 years with floating rate debt, you know, what's the best case scenario? What's the worst case scenario? I guess the worst case scenario is it's all gone, right?
Yeah. So I had a chart on one of my YouTube webinars that basically showed the peak was essentially, you know, I would say probably quarter four 21 to maybe quarter one 22 was probably the peak. So if you go from the peak to where we sit today, I would say A cap rates or A values have moved probably 20-25%, B's probably 25-30%, and then C's might have dropped 30-40%. Okay. Just on where cap rates are today versus where they were at the peak. Essentially, cap rates at the peak were like 4% for everything. And so now I would say it's probably 5.5, 6, and maybe 7 or 8 on C stuff. So when cap rates move that much, there's so much value that is lost that if you put on a loan that was 80% loan to value, then essentially your equity is wiped out on A, B, or C deals. And so I would start there. If you did a 60% loan, then you have some of your equity left. And this is all of you sell right now, right? So what is one of the hardest things to predict is the residual cap rate that you're going to sell a deal for 5 years from now. And what we're seeing is a lot of people who are buying deals today, their debt is 6%. They're buying at 5.5 to 6%, and they're using a residual cap of 5.5 or 5.75. And you're saying, well, don't you need to grow that cap by like 50 basis points? And people are like, well, it's going to come down when interest rates come down. So, you know, it's anybody's guess right now. But yeah, I mean, if you have a fixed rate loan on that deal and it was put on in 2021, where, you know, you don't have to sell today, then I think your equity is fine. It's the equity is at risk where you have a short-term maturity and a floating rate.
There's a large number of apartments coming online this year, yeah. In Texas, right? Austin, Dallas, Houston. Will this accelerate the number of distressed deals in 2024, do you think?
So it definitely is going to hit more of, you know, the A class lease up. I mean, I've seen in Austin maybe 2 to 3 months of concessions. In Dallas, you're probably 1 to 2 months of concessions. And this is why there's no rent growth, really. So I mean, I would say probably summer of 23 to today, there's been, you know, flat to negative rent growth in majority of the markets in Texas. And so it is hard to underwrite more rent growth in the next 12 to 18 months, or positive rent growth in the next 12 to 18 months, because of this new supply. And so, you know, it impacts everybody, but majority of the A deals, I would say most of those were done at probably 65-ish leverage. But most of the B and C stuff was done at 75 to 80.
And that's the stuff that's going to be in bigger trouble.
I think those are smaller operators. It's usually not institutional guys. And so, yeah, I think they're going to have to, if they cannot come up with the money, then they will be in distress.
So some or many, I guess, people in our community are living off the cash flow from these investments. And a lot of the deals stopped cash flowing and people have gotten used to regular monthly paychecks. And you talked about this a little bit when you talked about GE and when they kind of poof, the jobs went away. So what strategies can people use to protect themselves against decreased cash flow in a market like this for those that depend on it for income?
Well, I would say going forward, because you can't really change those deals once the wire's wired, it's done. I wish I could show a chart that basically shows the risk and return. If you have, let's say risk on the x-axis and return on the y-axis, most people would assume that you sort of just have a up and to the right line of risk and return. And that mentality, I think, makes sense. That's sort of what you learn in economics. But the way Howard Marks draws it in one of his books is it is a range of returns that is more important. And so if, let's say, you look at a deal that's a 10 IRR, you do not, on the pro forma, it says 10% IRR. You usually don't hit 10. You either hit a 9 or 11 IRR. That is the range of outcomes. And then if you go up the risk spectrum to, let's say, a 20 IRR, you don't hit a 20 IRR. You hit a 10 or you hit a 30 IRR. So think about it as more of a range of outcomes. And then to me, some of these deals that were done, let's say it was a 30 IRR. It was not it's not a 30 IRR. It's a 0 or it's a 60. Okay. So think about that in your mind. I'll send you a picture if you haven't seen this picture, but this picture I saw probably about 2 years ago, and it's changed my perception on thinking about returns in that way as a range of outcomes versus just a number, one number. And so when you overlay the type of debt that goes along with those range of returns, to me, a fixed rate Fannie Freddie loan that is 7 to 10 years fits in that sort of 10 IRR bucket where you're going to have a range of returns of 9 to 11. So you're not going to hit home runs and you're not going to get zeros. And so if your goal is to 100% have cash flow every quarter, every month, then that is the type of debt, those are the type of deals that I'm investing in. If you move up a little bit, let's say you go to 13 or 14% IRR, that's probably a Fannie Freddie floating rate deal. Okay. And then if you go up a little bit more up the curve and now you are, at a 20% IRR, then I would say that's a non-recourse bridge because you're going to get a higher return, but there's higher risk in that, right? You might get a 10 and you might get a 30. But then if you want to go all the way out on the curve, do you know what's all the way out on the curve? Is the non-recourse bridge with preferred equity. That is all the way out on the curve. That is your 30. And the first foreclosure that happened in 2023 in Houston was non-recourse bridge at 80% plus an additional 10 or 15% of preferred equity. And it got foreclosed in 12 months after close.
Wow. That's great. That's great stuff. And if you can send me that chart, I'll definitely put it in the show notes for everybody. Yeah. And we're getting close to time, but I have one more question from the community. And so if you have any distressed deals in your portfolio or for people that do, what would you have done differently in hindsight?
If I have distressed deals in the...
Yeah, or people that you've seen that have had distressed deals.
The first thing is I'm biased because I look at the debt on the transaction. So if I'm trying to learn from my mistakes, I would say look at the debt on the transaction. A lot of deals in 21 and 22, like basically every deal you saw was a bridge loan. So if you're trying to put out any money in 21 and 22, it was actually pretty hard to put out money. So I would look at the debt, number one. Number two, I would understand the sponsorship group and sort of what their expertise is and track record is. Because that right now, what we're finding out is that no matter this operator could be the best operator in the world, but if they do not have liquidity to weather this storm right now, then it doesn't matter, right? If they don't have the $1 million to kick the can down the road to get the additional interest rate cap and the LPs can't raise it, doesn't matter. So usually when I look at the sponsorship group, not only am I looking at their track record, I'm looking at their liquidity in the case that they need to support this deal and they can't raise it from the LPs. The thing that probably I've learned just through this cycle that I did not appreciate because I started in 15, in terms of investing, is really the timing, the cycle timing. And, you know, Jeremy Roll, which I'm sure you guys know, he was harping on me in 2021 that going from a 4 cap to a 5 cap is a lot worse than going from a 7 cap or 8 cap to a 9 cap. And I think people fail to recognize that in terms of value decline, is that as cap rates compressed, there was more risk of it reverting back to the mean. And it was a bigger increase than it went, when it went from, you know, a 7 to an 8. And so I'm a little bit more particular on cycle timing in my sort of investment philosophy. So a chart that I made probably, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago after investing in a couple of deals was I kept like every time I would get a deal, I sort of was like trying to justify whether or not to invest in the deal. But I sort of put the deals aside and said, all right, what's the investment philosophy and what is a deal that I should invest in? And listed out, let's say, 20 things. And so if I check all 20 boxes, I should invest in that deal. If I check 19, I probably should invest in the deal. because usually it is, usually all 20 are not checked. And so the thing that's on that list that in the last 2 or 3 years has been, you really should not invest when there is an inverted yield curve because the recession is coming based on history. And so I've ignored that. I've still done some investments the last 2 or 3 years, but it's been more selective when that in there. So some of the comments are more around more like yellow lights versus red lights. So I got some red lights and I got some yellow lights.
No, that's great stuff. So last question is what's a great podcast that you listen to?
So I'm going to throw out a bunch.
Excellent.
So if you want to go, let's see. So one guy in Texas who I think has done a phenomenal job and I do not know him is a guy called Chris Powers with the Fort podcast. He has done some fabulous interviews of guys here in Texas. And so maybe it's just Texas. I like him. And then I'm trying to think of, so this is outside of real estate, but there's a podcast called My First Million, and it is more tech startup, more like that one. And then if you have not listened to Naval Ravikant, he did a podcast, probably like a 3-hour podcast that whenever I'm driving for a very long time, I will just listen to that 3-hour podcast on repeat. And I'm trying to think if there's, and the two other guys, I would say, if you have not listened to Alex Hormozi, he has a podcast called The Game, and then Nick Huber, those would be probably in my rotation.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for that. And then finally, if listeners want to get in touch with you or learn more about what you do, what's the best way they can do that?
Best way is definitely email. So just send me an email and that's usually the best way to reach out. You can find me online. So Old Capital has a podcast, Old Capital Podcast. If you go on YouTube and just type in James Ng, multifamily, I have, I don't know, probably 100 or 200 videos on there just talking about what I do. But the thing that has stuck after all these YouTube videos is once a month, I put together like 15 or 20 slides and just go through what I'm seeing in the market. And that has probably had the biggest response.
Yeah, that's great stuff. Okay. Thank you, James. This has been fascinating. I appreciate you. I know we ran longer than we normally do, but the information you were throwing out was just fantastic. So we appreciate you being on the show.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jim.
Thanks.
Rustmill Capital is an elite Ohio-based private equity firm with a specialization in long-term, high cash flow multifamily investments. If you're looking for long-term recurring income, you should check out Rustmill Capital. From their approach to managing risk, to the locations they invest, the product quality they provide, this firm is serious about what they do, which is why the owners of Rustmill Capital invest their money in every deal they take on. Review their case studies by visiting rustbeltcapital.com. That's rustbeltcapital.com. Once again, rustbeltcapital.com or email investor@rustbeltcapital.com.
Hello, left fielders. At LFI, you know our focus is on networking and education. Mark your calendars because we're going to have a full day of it dedicated to you, our limited partners, at the Best Ever Conference on April 9th in Salt Lake City. LFI is opening the BEC with Passive Investing with Left Field Investors, an event focused on passive investors. This will be where insightful content meets passionate limited partners. If you enjoyed BEC last year and the meetup in Left Field this year, then imagine them both back to back. The Best Ever Conference isn't just any event. It's the premier conference for commercial real estate investors and operators. Your ticket to Passive Investing with Left Field Investors includes admission to the entire Best Ever Conference from April 9th through the 12th. Join us April 9th, where we will have a packed agenda with sessions focused on how to be a successful limited partner led by experienced LPs, top operators, and partners. Then, immerse yourself in the full Best Ever Conference, where you will be surrounded by like-minded investors, operators, and industry experts for unparalleled opportunities for learning and networking. The best part, and there are so many, but the best part, you won't find a bigger discount on the regular ticket price than the one you get for being an infielder. That's more content for an exclusive lower price. Register for the event today at leftfieldinvestors.com/BEC, and we will see you at Passive Investing with Left Field Investors at the BEC. Well, we went kind of long on that one, but man, how could you not? That was a fantastic conversation with James. He's just got so much knowledge and really digging in on the debt, which is really what has been causing most of the issues that we've been seeing and most of the troubles that we've been seeing. And I thought it was interesting that, you know, he talked about how he realized that realized recurring income, actual recurring income, was more powerful than a 401k, because the 401k, you're socking money in there, but you're not going to be able to use it for a long time. So if you put capital to use that gives you actual realized recurring income, you can build as you go, and you can actually use some of that money and not just save it for the end, you know, for retirement. So I thought that was interesting. He also talked about, you know, he's an LP himself and he's only invested in Texas. And, you know, we talk about diversification. And the one case I think that you have for maybe less diversification is when you have deep knowledge or deep expertise somewhere. And that's what he has. He really knows the Texas market. So he's all in it. And he's said, yeah, it's, you know, that Texas economy is as big as Canada. So it's like investing all throughout Canada. Now it still has some risks because he's more concentrated than others, but he should be able to be making better decisions in that market because he has such knowledge. And so what the key there is to recognize what knowledge you have and where your strengths are, and then invest to those strengths, which is what he's doing. And then his explanation of bridge loans versus Fannie Freddie was fantastic, and all the risks that it entails and the reasons people went so heavy into bridge loans. I mean, I am going to listen to those 15 minutes of this podcast over and over because it's really a great explanation. And then he talked about the chart that he sent that's in the show notes, and that really shows you that depending on the debt, that's where you are on the risk curve. You need to look at where you are on the risk curve and understand that a lot of that depends on what kind of debt you put into the deal. And, you know, leverage is awesome. It's also terrible. It depends on which side you're on and how your deal goes, where leverage can really evaporate all of your equity or it can multiply it. And I think what I've realized is, you know, you don't need the huge, huge returns. You just need to be solid returns for a long time rather than the big returns over a short amount of time. And then one other thing that I really, really like that he's talking about capital calls. And one of the main things he would look at is the length of time that they forecast that the capital call will prolong the deal, right? So if they're just saying, hey, it's just going to help us out through 1 year or 2 years, that's not going to get you through, right? It's got to be 3 years, 4 years, 7 years that the capital call is going to get you through to better times and let that deal get through. So that's another thing that that I think we need to start looking at more is the capital call. When you make that decision, you got to make sure that the deal is operating, you know, the operator's competent, but also how long is that capital call going to help? So really fascinating stuff. Really appreciate James spending all this time with us. Really knowledgeable guy. Certainly going to continue watching and checking out his YouTube channel because he's got some great content on there. So that's all I have for this time. We'll catch you next time in the left field. Thanks for hanging out in the left field with us today. If you are interested in becoming a left fielder, you can find us on the World Wide Web at www.leftfieldinvestor.com.
and click the subscribe button to join our community. If you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe to the show on your podcast player so you don't miss an episode. If you really enjoyed the show, a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts would be appreciated.
This show is for entertainment purposes only. Nothing said on the show should be considered financial advice. Before making any decisions, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by Passive Investing from Left Field and Left Field Investors. Written permissions must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.